Karen, we're going to share with you tonight and stretch your mind just a little bit. I suppose in the last few months that nothing has captured your mind or mine more than the aspect and the prospect of free energy. And tonight we'll talk about it and the men that have made it possible on Open Mind. All right, you ready for that? There are a lot of people that are deeply involved around the world of making free energy a reality for you, for me, for everyone. And they're not only in the United States, but they're all over, and there's some here in the United States. But the ones that have come to our attention are members of our family, you and mine, here on Open Mind. You've talked to them many, many times, and tonight you'll get to talk to them again. Because it is here, it is online, it is free energy. And I'm very delighted to have in studio with me a man who has electrified you on many, many occasions over the past few years. I hate to use the term electrified as a pun, but he has. Mr. Tom Bearden, who is one of our outstanding theoretical physicists. His credentials are deep and extensive, deeply involved in America's weapons research and the development of America's weapons systems. Deeply involved in analyzing what the Soviets are doing in their weapon systems, and certainly deeply involved in science and physics and free energy. Tom, welcome to Open Mind tonight. It's glad to have you. I'm glad to have you right here in the studio. Usually it's on the phone, but you know, there, right. There you're sitting right there.
A little earlier here.
Yeah. Also, a young man that took theory and made it real. Made it a part of our world, made it work, and Angelino, like the rest of us, and brought forth, really, a free energy device that works. Mr. John C. Bedini. John, welcome aboard. Glad to have you back.
Glad to be here, Bill.
And with John is the other half of what I call the Technobrats. What Tom dreams up and John dreams up, this man has a way of making it into hardware, Mr. Steve Wirth. Steve, welcome to Open Mind tonight.
Hello, Bill. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you with us. Also in the studio is Ike Mueller from NASA, who has done extensive work on John's machine. Ike, welcome aboard. Glad to have you with us.
Thank you for having me here.
And your work on John's machine, I think, was just incredible. You know, very thorough. You went through the whole thing. It stands right there.
Thank you.
Our subject tonight is free energy, and I want to go to Tom first, because, Tom, I know that this audience is very familiar with you. We hear talk about free energy. We hear about devices. We hear about schemes. We hear about perpetual motion machines. We hear about this and we hear about that. Are we really into the era now of having mastered the science of what we would call a free energy device?
We certainly have mastered the beginning of it, Bill. And certainly the Bedini device has point blank demonstrated that effect. Once again, we point out that when we talk about free energy, we're not talking about something esoteric. We're not talking about anything any different from putting a paddle wheel in a stream of water in a river. Nature furnishes the energy. If you can find the river and put the paddle wheel in there, you can get energy from that river and you can use it. The only thing we're talking about is a little bit more subtle river and a little bit more subtle paddle wheel. But nonetheless, we're talking about exactly the same kind of process, finding some of nature's rivers, electrical rivers, and tapping them in an electrical device, and that's what John has done. And others, too, but, you know, particularly the John Bedini device, the one I'm talking about.
Well, it seems to be head and shoulders above the others. In the case of, now, a couple of weeks ago, Joe Newman was a guest on the show, and I have an enormous respect for Joe Newman and his work, and particularly his fight with the bureaucrats and the courts in trying to get that patented. But in an appearance that we had at Town Hall earlier this week, I thought John stated it very well. Joe Newman's device develops an enormous amount of torque. John's device develops electricity. And therein is the difference.
That's correct. I believe Newman will get his patent. He's made a very strong case in the court He's made a very strong case in demonstrating it, and I believe the patent will be granted. Now, after the last court hearing, I think there's been a very strong finding in his favor. I don't really see how the patent office can continue to deny the patent in the face of a device which actually does burn itself and does prove the principle. So I believe he will finally get the device. John's device, of course, is sitting there. It does run, as you and he both just recently demonstrated right here in Los Angeles. The device is real. It produces the power. At that demonstration, he had it producing 2,000 watts of power, 2 kilowatts. So that is sufficient to prove that for a breadboard device, which it is, it's just the first buildup of a device.
Right. And we were looking at a very crude and primitive device there.
We're talking about a practical machine. Excuse me. We're talking about a machine that can be brought from where it is right now into development. And clearly foreseeable what you've got to do to develop it. It can be scaled up to give more power. And the machine is a practical machine. That is, it's a running machine. It doesn't call for any drastic change in the state-of-the-art of building electrical machines. It's just an unusual set of fabrications and techniques you use rather than you've got to have something totally new, like, for example, building an atomic construction would be. So it's a very practical machine.
Well, the bottom line, you know, we talk about a free energy device. You know, I think perhaps we need to come up with a new kind of nomenclature for it. Because it isn't free. The energy isn't free in that sense. There is a lot of time and effort that was expended in developing and putting it together. There's going to be time in maintaining. But when we say free, you're not going to have to stick your paddle in a river in order to turn a generator. Or you're not going to have to burn oil or gas in order to fire a furnace that will build steam to turn a generator. The device itself is tapping the sea of energy that we live in all of the time and creating the energy that we want. Is that one way to put it?
That's a good way to put it. In the word free, we meant free for the taking. We did not mean that it's free of any type of cost whatsoever. To direct anything, even to capture sunlight, which is free for the taking, you've got to build some kind of device. You've got to build some kind of construction. It's going to take you time and effort and research money to develop that, and it's going to cost you some money to build it. The point is, after you build it, it's going to continue to take the energy from the sun. And this is that kind of device. It's just coming from a little bit different source.
Well, I remember 10 years ago, I put 10 solar panels on my roof to heat the swimming pool. I figured that using that system rather than heating my swimming pool electrically, which is what I would have had to do where I was living, it would have taken about 9 months to amortize heating the pool. But nevertheless, I did have to put out the money. But after it was done and after it was paid for, the rest of it was just maintenance. We're talking about now the technology for you to have a machine at your home about the size of, or maybe half the size of, the little thing outside whenever you have an air conditioning system that runs and gives you all of the energy you want, and you don't need any outside sources. All you have to do is buy that machine and maintain it. Am I correct?
That's correct. It'll take some maintenance. You know, you've got the oil bearings once in a while. any kind of device you build will have a mechanical breakdown once in a while. There will certainly occur from time to time an electrical breakdown in any kind of electrical machine, but the machine is of the type that those things are minimal. And so the machine in production, that is, once all the research costs for the final production set have been spent, in other words, your sunk costs are there, the machine can be made down the road after the tools and dies and all, and this sort of thing, can be made relatively cheaply. So we're not talking about something that in production is going to cost $10,000. We're talking about something that in production, if I had to give you a seat-of-the-pants estimate, I would say $1,000.
Or maybe less.
Depending on how big a unit you've got to have.
But for the average home?
For the average home, I would guess that the eventual production cost will be $1,000 or less.
To your right is Ike Mueller. Do you want to tell us a little bit about who he is? Because I want to ask him about his reflection on that machine. I know he spent a lot of time with it. Give us his background.
Well, Ike Mueller is an aerospace engineer. For some time, he represented the German effort with NASA in the space area. He is presently the U.S. representative for a German firm called the MIT Corporation. Ike has a very interested and varied background. He has looked at great numbers of devices, all kinds of machines. He's quite a production engineer, I might add. He's quite skilled at putting together technical projects, producing hardware that rolls out the end and rolls down the assembly line. That's his specialty. And he's also a good, very good man in electronics. He knows what he's doing in that field. So, yes, he's a good friend and a good engineer, and it's a pleasure to have him here with us.
Ike, I want to get your reactions to the time that you've spent with John Bedini's free energy device in just a moment. We are talking free energy, and if anybody knows free energy, I think we have them right here in the studio to talk to you, and we'll get to all of them, and we'll get to you in just a moment. I'm Bill Jenkins. It's Open Mind. We're talking about you having free access to all of the energy you need for anything that you want it for. We've been talking to Tom Bearden, one of the, I think, the nation's foremost theoretical physicist who has been talking to us about this for a long time. And Tom, I think that whenever you saw it finally come into fruition, that it finally happened, these things we were talking about, you must have been exhilarated that night.
It's like having a dream come true.
A dream came true. I want to talk to Ike Mueller right now. Ike has written a book about the Bedini device, a scientific paper, which is available through the Tesla Book Company. We'll tell you more about that in a little bit. But Ike, you spent days with John. You went over that machine tooth and toenail. Does it work? Are we really talking about free energy?
Well, it works better than I thought it would work.
You thought?
When I first measured the machine, I found many things which are not very common that they can happen.
Mm-hmm.
So when we loaded, for instance, down this machine, it turned out that the machine was running easier. This means it needed less energy. We measured this effect, and we found a very good relationship also. This means when we even shorted the output on this machine, the power intake of the machine was decreasing rapidly.
So it's working backwards from a normal electric...
Totally backwards, yeah.
Everything about it is backwards. What happens whenever you hook it up to your house? Is the house going to be backwards?
No, I don't hope so.
Well, in short, the more the machine is demanded of it to work and produce energy, the more it seems to like it. Is that it? It really goes to work.
Exactly.
And if you ask it not to work much, now if you turn everything off in the house, it really starts cutting up on you. In fact, it wants to stall out. Yeah, you got to find something for it to do if you don't need it, right?
Exactly.
I suppose you can do that with all kinds of little relays and things like that.
I think that's state of the art, yeah.
It also, as we saw at Town Hall this week, it uses extremely little wires. The bigger the amount of electricity that it's producing, the smaller the wires seem to have to
be.
That's
right.
Why is that? Isn't that backwards? It should work the other way, it seems to me.
Well, you better ask Tom, you know, about the reasons what's behind. But see, I'm very practical. I want to get it working that everybody can use it.
Mm-hmm.
And in earlier times, I worked in space business and space projects because it was a new land. It was where you can put some new ideas to work. We work with not only ideas, but also with materials, for instance, in satellite business, which were not invented at the time when we worked with them. So we had to do something new. And here it's very similar. That's the reason that I now started to work in this alternate energy field, because it's a new land. And we know that it works, and we just have to put it together.
Well, that's the thing I want to keep impressing upon the minds of those people who are having trouble with this. We do have a machine that does tap the sea of energy in which we live, and it produces electricity. And you don't have to fire any other kind of fuel to make it work. It just works because the energy is there and it knows how to tap them. Is that,
yes,
is that one way of putting it? I know it's oversimplified, but that...
No, that's the way it does.
Is there anything else you want to add on to that before I get to the technobrats over there and get there?
Well, maybe later.
Okay. Sitting next to Ike Mueller is the young man who thought and dreamed and had an idea. And by golly, he did it, Mr. John C. Bedini. John, welcome to Open Mind again.
Welcome, Bill.
Your little machine just hums right along, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's sort of it's unusual, as I tried to explain to the people out there before. It was pretty hard to kind of see this from an engineering point of view. Generators don't speed up, Bill. They slow down. You know,
whenever you make them work, they start slowing down.
Right.
They're like you and I.
You go to the textbooks, and the first thing that you learn is you have to wind the coils a certain way. The magnets have to be a certain way. And the minute you connect the load, I think, not to jump the gun here, not to change the subject, I think everybody dreams of connecting a motor to a generator and then connecting the generator's output back to the motor. And somehow when they do that, the motor always stops.
It runs out of gas somewhere along the line.
Somewhere. You know, you just can't do it. The generator can never put out over what the motor is taking in.
Yours does, John.
Well, yeah, this one runs backwards because if there's 2,000 watts at the load, there's 2,000 watts inside the generator to keep it spinning, mm-hmm. You know, which is absolutely an impossibility under conventional theory. But, however, I am a firm believer that I've been taught wrong
mm-hmm.
by some strange means. I mean, why did I pay all this money to go to school, you know, through correspondence and everything else, to learn now, 11 years later, that it's not so? That the textbook, what's missing from the textbook? I mean, what are we going to get out of all this?
Well, you know, that's an interesting point you bring up, John, and it's something that we've talked about, certainly Tom and I have, for the last 3 years, that we have this this great thing out there called academia, and
right.
Perhaps some of academia is listening to us tonight. The physicists that are working in the space industry at TRW and North American Rockwell and all of these great citadels of knowledge and physics, that what they're doing is wrong. It doesn't work. I was very intrigued with our presentation at Town Hall earlier this week, and we had some designers of the shuttle,
right.
And they looked at your machine, and they tested it, and fiddled with it, and played with it, and they finally said, how come we're spending so much money on fuel cells,
right.
Taking up all of this time and payload and millions of dollars to develop these fuel cells whenever that little breadboard model that you were displaying, and that was a very crude device, would have done the job for them.
Yeah, you see, because one of them right after that demonstration came up to me and he says, why are we spending all this money on fuel tanks? He said, we really don't need any fuel tanks. If we just figure out how it's capturing the energy, we can just leave without the fuel tanks.
Well, the ramifications of it
right.
are enormous.
Right.
One of the things I would like to throw up, there may be some people listening here who fancy themselves of being, and indeed are, very much physicists. They're very, very deeply involved in the world of physics that we have, you know, that is a part of the world we live in. And we're challenging you. You know, those things that you learned in school are wrong. And those things that you're working with every day are wrong. And if you don't think so, you've got some pretty good minds to toss that over with. And we have till midnight for you to go back and forth with Tom Bearden and Ike Mueller and John Bedini and you, that little fellow on your right over
yeah.
there who doesn't like to say too much, Steve Wirth. Steve, welcome aboard tonight. Steve has a way of listening to what Tom says and what John says and running off and hitting his computer and his machine. The next thing you know, he's coming out with his little part. He's a magician with that thing. What did you think, Steve, the first time that you were asked to make this little doodad or that little doodad? And I know you argue a lot about that because for some reason or another, you understand who Nikola Tesla was and who T. Henry Morey was and what their theory is all about. You guys just get together. We're going to... When those two get together, we're talking about an explosion.
Well, John, he comes up with these mad ideas, and we look at them. And I says, okay, let's give it a try. And we put it together, and then we fire one up and check out and see where we made a mistake, if there is any, or we discover new ideas.
Blow up a couple
and,
batteries.
Yeah. Blow up a couple batteries or mess up a few wires here and there. And we're going through a large learning curve, and we've learned an awful lot in the last year. And John and I, we've got on the drawing board to build bigger ones, like a 10 kilowatt and then up to 50 kilowatt, and also up to 160 kilowatt generator.
Well, Steve, you're a very practical businessman. You're In a business of a no-nonsense business, you've looked at this, you've played with this. Is that free energy device producing energy in your estimation?
Oh, yes. It's producing way more than I've ever seen, and even the price-wise. Because, give example, say the machine is 1,000 for 10 kilowatt. If I'm mistaken, if you went to buy one off the commercial shelf, we're talking around 4,000 or 5,000.
Uh-huh.
And then you have to put gas in it.
Yeah, but this one, you don't have to put gas in it.
No.
You don't have to put oil in it. You don't have to do anything. You just turn it on.
Turn it on.
But, Steve, you might add, you know, for the people out there, the many flops before the machine actually ran.
Right.
I mean, Bill, it's impossible to burn out number 18 wire and find that in the number 18 wire, there was just one little arc that took place. You know,
well, what is a number 18 wire? You got to look. You know, I'm a radio guy. I'm not a physicist here.
Well, number 18 wire is about
60,000 diameter.
Yeah, it's we wound this stuff, me and Steve, on these armature poles, and of course, you know, we wanted to see the machine run. But when we fired the machine up, as Steve can tell you, how many coils did it burn out?
It burned out 8 at one time, and that takes a tremendous amount of voltage. Burn out that size coil wires.
But tell them, Steve, how big the burn mark was. It was about the size of the end of a little needle point.
Yeah, all through.
Well, I've seen a few burn marks on both of you from time to time.
Bill was
you get too close to the machine.
It was very interesting on the machine. As you light up like 2,000 watt light bulbs, and we're only using a diameter of wire, 10,000 diameter. Mm-hmm. That's very small diameter. And if you went to put that in a regular 110 wall plug the same way, it fried that wire before it even knew the light bulb was there.
Well, as we had in the demonstration this week at Town Hall, you were firing up about 2,000 watts of energy there with the light bulbs
load,
and
yeah.
The heater and the whole thing. You were using number 30 wire?
Well, what I was using as a load was 8 100-watt light bulbs in parallel. And also a 600-watt quartz glow heater down the center of the light bulbs.
Right.
And they were all in parallel with each other, which meant that the impedance of that circuit had to be around 1/10 of an ohm just firing up. And I think you remember, Bill, that the quartz glow heater was way over the brilliancy of what that heater should have been.
Yeah, it was doing its number, but you were feeding that with this wire that's smaller than a hair.
Right, I was feeding it with number 32 wire.
Number 32?
Yeah, to be exact, that was number 32 wire. And we even called a person out of the audience and had him grab the wires.
Which should have burned up.
Right, should have burned up in his hands. And I told the people before I started the demonstration that if I took the load off the machine, why, the motor that was driving this thing would just stall off their wall current. And, you know, everybody says, well, there's no way you're going to stall that motor, John. If it turns the machine, it's going to run it. And sure enough, we took the wires off it, as you saw and Steve saw and everybody that was present there. As soon as that load was removed from that machine, why, I couldn't suck any more energy in, so quit. That was it.
That's right. It has to be working or it won't work.
That's right.
That's a strange thing about that.
It's a very unusual set of scientific circumstances that we're playing with here.
I hope that we have provoked your imagination just a little bit, and I want to give you some numbers where you want to talk to these people, because what they're doing is, if you read the physics books, is impossible. And I would suspect that if you call Caltech or UCLA or USC, their physics departments, or any of the high-tech industries we have in Los Angeles, which are many, and ask them if this could be done, they would tell you, no, it cannot be done. But the fact of the matter is that despite what they said, nobody checked with them, and it's being done. And if you have some questions about it, here's your chance. Let me give you the numbers. They all end in talk, T-A-L-K. In Los Angeles, your prefix is 520-TALK, T-A-L-K, or 8255. In the San Fernando Valley, 990. In Orange County, 750. If you're in Glendale, Pasadena, or Burbank, your number is 244. If you're in the San Gabriel Valley, your number is 448. If you're down in the South Bay, that's Rolling Hills, Palos Verdes, Manhattan Beach, Hawthorne, Hermosa Beach, all along through there, El Segundo, 679. If you're in Long Beach, San Pedro, Paramount, that area, call us at 639, and let's talk free energy. Let's talk about the impossible actually being here. I'm Bill Jenkins. It's Open Mind.
Yeah?
In the barometer, whatever is on your mind, and I think that Brian wants to talk about a little bit of all of that. Brian, welcome aboard.
How are you doing, Bill?
I'm doing fine.
I enjoyed your speech the other day at the town hall.
Oh, were you there?
Yes, I was.
Did that work?
Oh, you bet it did. Blew me away.
Did it now?
Oh, you bet. I couldn't believe it. It was there, and I had read about it, but I couldn't believe I was seeing it.
You saw the device.
Mm-hmm.
It works.
You bet.
You checked it out?
Yes. I put a meter on it, too.
You were the one to put a meter on it.
Yeah.
You know, that's dangerous with those meters. Brian, what's your background?
Well, I'm a technician with a Southern California firm.
Uh-huh.
And I do field engineering, and I've been interested in this since I first heard about it.
Did you feel that you were going to find some snake oil there or somebody just playing games with you?
You know, I started to have doubts about it when I saw it there because I couldn't believe, like I said, what I was seeing.
It is a crude-looking little thing, isn't it?
But it works, and that's the best part about it. It is as advertised.
Thank you very much, Brian. You have some questions for... We've got them all here.
Well, I wanted to ask your panel of experts about scalar technology. Is scalar technology being used to detect the site of future earthquakes in Southern California? And if so, is there still going to be a Southern California here in 5 years? Whoever, John or Tom, whoever.
I don't have any. This is Tom. I don't have any knowledge of the use of scalar technology yet, except for Professor Sanchez and John Bedini.
Right.
I believe Beck has one scalar detector or more as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that's about the people right now that are using scalar technology, or at least that are admitting they're using it. I believe there are lots of people that are experimenting with it.
Dr. Beck will be on the show.
Excuse me, I turned my mic on. Dr. Beck will be on the show on the 30th of March, by the way, so you can ask him also what he's doing with
right.
it. I think he wants to talk about that.
Right.
Okay.
Certainly, the scalar electromagnetics could be applied to that. And Brother John here has... I don't know if he wants me to say anything about those detectors or
yeah,
not.
Yeah, you go ahead.
He's got some super detectors. I've just recently, just within the last few days, gotten one from him, which is a rather incredible device. It reaches so far down, from the standpoint of normal electromagnetics... He's reaching down 160 or 200 dB down in the noise and pulling out intelligible signals. Now, before we say that's just noise, since it's in the noise, let me explain a little something that what's actually going on. What he's actually doing, the scalar, as you know, is two or more things which sum to a zero vector. But nothing made by man or nature or anything else is a perfect summation. If you can get fine enough in there, you can find that it's just a little bit off. There's a little residue that you can pick up. So what he's really doing is he's going way down below where anybody, as far as I know, has ever been with a detector, and he's picking up that little bit of variation in the actual fields and things that make up the scalar itself. He's picking up the wobble, so to speak, in the components. And he's bringing that out and looking at it, and it's there's some incredible things. For example, at my own home, I've found that there's a very steady and very directional 0.07 hertz wave, scalar wave, that is sitting there in just resonance in that area. I don't know if it's the whole earth or if it's just the area where my house sits or where it's Huntsville, Alabama. But there is a 0.07 hertz wave that's just as steady and regular as a clock, and it's directional. It's almost north and south. Maybe John would like to crack at that one.
Yes, up in this area towards, let's go up towards the fault line a little bit more, towards the Sylmar area, where the last big quake took place. Up there, there is a 2 to 400 cycle resonant wave, which is longitudinal, that's building every day. And this wave is varying around. You see, if there's a real important thing to look at here, that all these little things that are generating minute bits of energy.
John, do you mind if I stop you for just a second? I want you to collect your thoughts,
okay,
because I have to collect a bunch of commercials.
Okay.
We have. And, Brian, would you hang on for just a second?
Sure will, Bill.
Well, Bill throws another scale wave in your direction.
Okay.
That kind of helps pay for all of this. I'm Bill John, the world to talk about it with. Tom Bearden is here. Ike Mueller is here. John Bedini and Steve Wirth are here. And we were talking to Brian when we took a little break. Brian, we want to finish the conversation with you.
Okay.
All right. Brian, we're in the middle of John talking to you about what's happening up on the fault line with the scalar waves.
Okay.
All right, Brian. So anyway, to get back to this, we have been reading these buildups longitudinally. Now, let me explain something to you. This tuner that we are building... You see, what us engineers consider noise is electronic noise. In other words, we always try to filter out the noise, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. However, what is generating that noise is far below that, okay, and that is the scalar. But the important thing for you to understand, before you can read this, you have to convert it into some means in which you can display it, okay?
Mm-hmm.
What that requires is taking the signal from the tuner after being completely filtered at minus 160 dB down. Now, that sounds like an incredible figure, doesn't it?
Yes, very much so.
It's not. It's nothing, okay? It's the limits of what most of the devices will go if you pick a good set, okay?
Right.
And what we do with that is we take it down and we read the shift in that. We bring it back up through a pulse width modulator. Are you familiar with that?
Yes.
Okay. Because, see, the pulse width modulator is going to read longitudinally. It's going to change longitudinally. Do you
mm-hmm.
follow
mm-hmm.
what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And then what we do is bring that back to analog and put it on the scope.
Oh.
Okay?
Yes.
Then all the noise is filtered out. You follow me?
Yeah.
Then anything that comes through is going to look like musical wave notes. You follow me?
I see.
If you plucked a guitar... And you watch the guitar, the musical note die out, you would see this shift in this pattern as the wave changed its phasing through its spectrum. You understand that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But now to sum this all up, there's something very important to remember, and I want Tom Bearden to answer this question about what's down below this noise.
Well, there are many things, John, that are down there, and Brian. Point out to you that a scalar wave, if you look at it from the aspect of ordinary electromagnetics, you're talking about things opposing themselves. Technically, it is a stress wave. It is not a force field wave consisting of only one E field and one B field is changing.
Right.
It's a stress. The closest analogy we can give you is like the pressure in a gas, and the pressure is pulsating. Only now we have pulsating E fields and B fields that always sum to zero. This kind of a wave goes right straight through the electron shell around an atom. It goes down into the nucleus, and it interacts directly with a strong force that binds the nucleons together. Now, the nucleus itself, when it puts out waves, it puts out a great deal of scalar waves all the time. They go right through the electron shells, and they go on out and they interact with other nuclei. The entire universe, the nucleuses, the nuclei of all the atoms in the universe, are in constant and total scalar communication. And our instruments, which have been developed for the single force field electromagnetics that interacts with the electron shells, we've been going around looking at the electron shell stuff.
Yeah.
We have not looked at the great cosmic engines of the universe, which are really... coming out of the nucleus.
Hey, listen, guys, can I break it off here? Brian, we spent a lot of time with you here. I know that you would like to probably talk to him all night long, but we're really, really short on time. I hope that helps you a lot, okay?
That does.
All right, now stay with us because we've got two more hours of this, all right? I'm Bill Jenkins. We're talking free energy tonight on Open Mind.
Hi, this is Don Anderson.
For just a second, Chuck. We're going to break away real fast, but you want to talk about the vacuum of energy?
Well, right. The
sea, you know, that great sea that they're talking about,
mm-hmm.
and to discuss the scalar technology having to do with that. Is there time for that?
Well, not before the news, but I wanted to get you on the line. We're going to take a break here in just a second, but you can sort of phrase your question. Our walking music is going to come in on top of us here in just a
okay,
second.
Okay, well, as Tom remembers...
In fact, there it is.
Okay, well... Okay, I'll hold on.
All right, I want you to hold on, because we'll get into the sea of energy and how you tap that sea of energy and how it is being tapped and how that's going to change the whole world.
All right, sounds good.
Thank you for your question. We're going to take a break for news at 10 o'clock on Open Mind.
Do with this river of energy, if you take the statement that you made some time ago, Tom, about the Tesla coil, as he created this big energy, if the folks remember the big large coil with the ball on top and all these sparks flying off. But you made a very cogent statement in that when those sparks take place, the bets are all off, in that the potential energy stored before the spark takes place is the domain where things are really happening, and that modulating that area before the sparks cause the breakdown of what's happening. Is there some analogy to these really thin wires supposedly carrying kilowatts of energy, but in a reverse direction? Or is that some sort of, or could it be that while you're in this domain before the sparks break across, are you working in a negative time area kind of thing? If you can remember a statement attributed to Wheeler where he says, time is nature's way of keeping things from happening all at once. Are you working around in that area?
The answer is yes. Point out that the scalar wave from the normal viewpoint represents a zero vector. It does not, if it were a perfect wave, it would not move electrons at all. And that's how John puts it through the little bitty wire. He's actually putting a zero vector wave through there. And so the electrons in the wire, which have to move themselves to cause heating in the wire, the only disturbance in those electrons he has is the part of the wave that's not perfect. If it were a perfect wave, he wouldn't move one electron. And so it goes directly into the load, which is then nonlinear. It strips it back apart and you get all kinds of energy there. That's the way that happens. Now, the negative time part, the vacuum itself is nothing in the world, but this kind of oppositions of fields. In classical electrodynamics, we already know that in little bitty, tiny increments of time, we have enormous surges of field changes. Well, you got one this way, you got one that way, and they're opposing each other in there, and that's scalar. So the vacuum really is a large scalar field. That's one way to put it. Another way to say it, it's just a large potential.
It's just potential energy, unmanifest energy, basically.
That's correct. It's just raw potential. But you can structure it. You can polarize it. You can set up waves down in it through the vacuum that stay down below the surface, so to speak, like a submarine. You can do all sorts of things in it. But when you put extra scalar waves in there, extra artificial potential, you're actually warping and twisting the space-time.
But how do you calculate something like that?
Well, it's fairly simple. You take the definition of the amplitude as being the sum of the absolute values of the amplitudes of all the waves opposing each other. Let me say that real quick. And that'll give you the amplitude of the scalar waves. Then as they vary and always stay summed to zero, the summation of the absolute values varies. That's it. Well, it's like saying if I have an E field that goes positive and another E field that goes negative.
Well, I understand. I see the arithmetic, but yeah. I'm just saying that these small wires are boggling my mind now. What is the purpose of the wires if they're really, really small? I mean, you're saying there were number 64 wire?
No, there were 32 wires.
Okay, but I'm saying if you reduce the diameter even further, it would carry more energy?
If the wave that he was making in the machine is not perfect, if the wave were perfect, if it were possible to make an absolutely perfect scalar wave, he could use a wire much finer than a human hair and still put as much energy as he wants through it in that form. It's energy locked against itself. It doesn't evidence as ordinary energy in that form.
Now, did these lamps create heat?
Yes, they do. The lamp, the scalar wave breaks apart into the components and it turns back into ordinary energy. And so the lamp lights up. Electrons move. It gives off light, real energy.
It's not a fluorescing thing, you know, the other technology.
No, it's real energy that you can measure. You can see it radiating away. It's bright. It illuminates the room. It's real power.
Well, a friend of mine and I, Earl, out in the valley, we've been discussing this for 3 years or so, and we're ex-microwavers, you know. And
right.
And now we're down here talking about zero frequency.
No, zero vector. The frequency is not zero at all. For example,
you could pump these vectors at some audio rate then, or some other rate. These vectors can be moved around at, say, microwave frequencies again.
Sure, you can move them around at light frequencies, microwave frequencies, and by the way...
So that's how you would do this transmission thing. You would take two scalar waves or two sources and create a third dimension or a third point.
A scalar wave represents an oscillation of the curvature of space-time. In other words, from no curvature, you curve it positive and you curve it negative. That's what you're doing now.
About zero.
About zero. Now, that's a general relativistic wave. It is not a special relativistic wave. It's totally different from everything we've been using in the textbooks. By the way, you mentioned microwave. Professor Ramon Sanchez has just joined us, and Sanchez has done experiments in the microwave region with scalar waves, and he's done the cross beams at a distance experiment to make energy at a distance, and he's also changed the potentials and extracted energy from a distance. He's done the experiments, they do work.
That's still phenomenal.
All right, Chuck.
Chuck talked about reaching down into the noise.
Well, okay, the noise is, he's talking about the electrons.
I understand synchronous detectors can be made to do things like reaching 160 dB below the noise. That's nothing new, but you're talking about going, using these scalar frequencies, 0.07 hertz, to lock onto some other energy, or some other frequencies or information or whatever.
What you've got is a, let me see if I can address that. Energy.
Make it quick.
I have
guys.
To make it real quick, so grab
okay,
it real quick.
I'll go up there.
Here it is. Energy itself is tied to the idea of doing work. It's work you haven't done yet. If you ever turn it loose, it'll do work and give it some resistance. Now, work is totally tied to the concept of one single force moving against a resisting mass, F dot ds. That gives you dw.
Okay,
now, what we have here is literally not energy. It is each little vector that's opposing there and varying. It, if you could separate it by itself, it would have energy. But since they're all locked together, they do not have energy. In other words, the difference between pressure and the release of pressure in a single vector is what we're talking about. They are two entirely different things.
And the resultant effect of that are these waveforms that he's picking up.
That's right. A wave of pure potential. That's the best way to look at it.
At nearly zero frequency.
No, at any frequency you wish to make. Whatever you wish to make, and any combinations of them you wish to make. You can do Fourier transform, Fourier expansion, the whole thing.
I got my little app here that does those things. Thank you.
All right, Chuck. Thank you very much
and thanks for talking to you guys.
Good penetrating questions. And for those of you that are just joining us, it may sound like we're talking about something that is very, very scientific. You're absolutely correct, it is. But I want you to stay with us because they're trying to put it in a way that I can understand it, and I figure that if I can understand it, you can. But the bottom line is that basically we're talking about the fact that the technology is here, the machinery is online, that is going to be able to give you all of the electrical energy you need, and it's not going to cost you anything other than buying the machine, which is going to be inexpensive when it finally... And it will be done shortly, and maintaining it. You can disconnect from the Department of Water and Power. That's what we're talking about. It is online. It is real. It is here. So it would behoove you to stay. It's not above your head, and you may want to find out about this, and you may well have some questions you want to ask about that. Let me quickly give you the numbers. In Los Angeles, the number is 520 or 8255. In the San Fernando Valley, 990. Orange County, it's 750. All the numbers end in talk, T-A-L-K. In Burbank, Glendale, and Pasadena, it's 244. In the San Gabriel Valley, we're talking 448-TALK. In the South Bay area, 679-639 down in Long Beach, San Pedro, and Paramount. We want you to get in here and talk to us about free energy, and I have the world's leading experts on it with me right now, so this is your chance. I'm Bill Jenkins. It's Open Mind.
We're talking about a science that not too many people know about, but we certainly have a studio full of people who do know about it. And if you have some questions, you're invited to get in on it. And I do believe that we have Lloyd on the line. Lloyd, you want to build one of these machines?
Yes, sir. I'd like to try that. It's very exciting, I think.
Yeah, it is.
Where do I start? I'd like to get schematics or something.
Well, we have John Bedini here, and he has given the basic information to that into the public domain. And, John, you might as well tell him how to get that.
All right. You get the, to study the waves, you get the first book, which takes you through. What I was hoping was that, like I explained at the conference the other day, that everybody would catch on to these waves. In other words, what I was hoping was that people would pick up right away that there was a difference in the two waves, and that's how you were getting the energy. The generator, first of all, is a it's a very simple thing to do. I must say, simple in its construction. However, in its tuning, it's very difficult.
I can imagine.
I don't know, you know, what your background is.
I worked as an aircraft worker way back in the 30s, right on through, and I have my own shop. Tune time, but I'm not so much in the electronic field, but I can get probably all the help I need.
Well, I think perhaps, John, one of the best things we can do is to get the
book,
the paper that you and you have put out, and Ike Mueller. There's two, really.
Where can I?
Let me give you the address for those. And certainly, John is not in the business of selling booklets, but we want you to get that information. It is the Tesla Book Company.
How's that spelled?
Tesla. You know who Nikola Tesla was?
Tesla.
T-E-S-L-A. Tesla Book Company. 1580 Magnolia.
1580
Magnolia.
Magnolia.
And that's in Millbrae, California. M-I-L-L-B-R-A-E, or is it E-A? A-E. 94030. And just ask for the John Ratzliff up there for the two books about the Bedini device. They are two papers, actually. They're scientific papers.
I didn't get that town. Millbrae,
M-I-L-L-B-R-A-E. And if you missed that, we have that address on file here for you at Broadcast Information.
Mm-hmm.
All right, now.
And I can call in if I.
You certainly can. Certainly. Mm-hmm. Just call KABC and ask for Broadcast Information. They'll give you the address. But in that, I think, is enough information for you to get started. There's six or seven of the machines that are working in the Los Angeles area from that.
Yeah.
I'm located over in Alhambra, South El Monte, really.
So you'll be able to do it. I hope that'll help you, Lloyd.
Bill, there is one more important thing.
Yes.
If you have a problem with the electronics, in other words, for the controller, Bedini Electronics builds that. And that's $95 retail, okay?
Yeah, well, the cost is, I imagine, is minimum.
Well, yeah, but it's very important that your phasing's right. See, a lot of people jump right into the machine and think that they're going to make this thing run, and then they run into phasing problems.
I am quite aware of it. It's very technical.
Yeah, so.
Well, it's a good way to get started, Lloyd, and then John, try to help you out from there. But to find out that it does happen, it's a new science, and if you're going to get in there and fiddle with it, we think that's great.
Yes, well I understand there's someone in East Los Angeles that is working on one.
Well,
right?
They're all over.
Uh-huh.
There's many people.
Many people are doing it. It is a reality. Okay, Lloyd?
Yes, thank you.
All right, thank you for being
Bye.
A part of it.
Bye.
We're talking free energy tonight. I'm Bill Jenkins. It's Open Mind. Glad to have you aboard. Mind. I'm Bill Jenkins, and with me is Tom Bearden, Ike Mueller, John Bedini, Steve Wirth. Professor Ramon Sanchez just joined us, and we're talking about a lot of brain power here. If you want to talk about scalar interferometry, all of these free energy. I could use the terms, guys, but I don't know what it means. But there are a lot of people out there that do, and I think that who wanted to talk to us here? Gus, I think, is on the line. Gus, welcome aboard.
Yes, good evening, Bill.
Yes.
My question is basically, I want to ask Mr. Bearden, if he could possibly explain the difference between the John Newman device and Mr. Bedini's device. Is that possible?
Yes, of course.
I have never seen Newman's device personally.
But you have an idea about it.
But my idea of it, I think, is best summed up the way John said it. His device produces torque, you know, which we're talking about a magnetic effect.
Yes.
John's device produces electricity directly in the load itself. In other words, if you take the load of the latest Bedini device,
yes,
and if you isolate that as a subsystem, and you, if you use normal electromagnetic instruments to measure what's going in, you get almost zero going in, very little ordinary electricity going into it. Now, there's a lot of the other kind of electricity going into it that doesn't show on your normal instrument. In the load itself, the unusual electricity is turned into usual electricity, and so it then produces ordinary power, ordinary energy, and ordinary electrical energy. So they're two quite different machines with two quite different effects and two quite different concepts.
I see.
Is there going to be... They both are doing the job, by the way.
I'm sorry?
And they both are real, by the way.
Uh-huh.
And I believe Newman will get a patent on his machine. I believe he's the court...
Yes.
Has ruled very strongly in his favor and has essentially stated that there's absolutely no reason the patent shouldn't be granted him because the machine does operate.
We got to remember that since the turn of the century, it's been impossible to get a patent on a free energy device because the powers that be did not want you and me to have free energy. And
yes,
that was one of the ways they stopped it.
And before we leave that, let's address that question. You're never going to get free energy as long as your system stays linear, as long as you don't change space-time somewhere or another. In other words, as long as you have to put in as much as you get out, you're never going to get free energy. Now, I'll say something a little technical, say it real quick, and then shut up.
Okay.
If you bend space-time locally, if in the machine itself you are warping space-time, you're now in general relativity. Now, in general relativity, when you have such a situation, if you bend it one way, that machine will look like it's got a hidden source. Now, this is real. This is not fictitious. This is ordinary general relativity.
Yes.
And it will produce energy that you can draw from it. Now, it'll take it from somewhere else in the universe. But it's like having waves bring energy to you out of the ocean. They come from somewhere, but they come free to you. And you can do that. If you bend it the other way, it'll look like it's got a sink. It will soak up energy. And energy will disappear into it. And that'll give you, around it, you'll see it giving a cooling effect.
Is there any conflict, like when Mr. Newman gets his patent, will there be any conflict, like someone coming up with all these free energy devices?
I think what you're going to see is probably the biggest barrier we have is in our mindset. We have been told so long that you can't violate conservation of energy, and that's nonsense. You can do it in any local general relativistic system. Every virtual state interaction violates conservation of energy. That's already in the textbook. So, you know, that's a bunch of nonsense. In ordinary physics, you can already violate the conservation of energy law. There are several other cases that are already recognized as violating it. All you have to do is be clever enough to tap one of nature's mechanisms that she's already given to you. And I think that once this mindset is overcome, you're going to see all kinds of people building all kinds of free energy devices. And I hope John Bedini is going to build about 10 of them.
Well, yeah, there will be a lot of free energy devices out there. It'll be a very, very competitive situation, I think, in a very short period of time once people realize they can do it. And they better realize it because there are a lot of people doing it already. The physicists who tell you that it cannot be done just happen to be dead wrong. And get that in your mind and understand that. They are wrong.
No good physicist is going to tell you that you can't build a free energy system if you tell him that you've been able to warp space-time on the laboratory bench. If he tells you can't do it after you've done that, he doesn't know physics.
Does that help you, Gus?
Sure does.
All right.
Sure
thank does. You very much for your good question.
Thank you,
I'm
Bill.
Bill Jenkins. We're talking open mind. We're talking about a science that a lot of the scientists would tell you doesn't exist, but, you know, that's what this program is all about anyway. A lot of brain power to talk to you about free energy tonight. Free energy. Your ability to tap all of the energy you will ever need for whatever you want to do, and it's not going to cost you anything. That science is here. It's online. And to help discuss that with me is Tom Bearden, Ike Mueller, John Bedini, Steve Wirth, and Ramon Sanchez. And if anybody knows about those things, these gentlemen do. And we have Richard on the line who wants to talk to us about financing these devices. Richard, what's on your mind?
Good evening, Bill. A couple of questions. The last phrase you used were the ordinary physicists were dead wrong.
Whenever they say you can't develop a free energy device, which many of them say.
That's right. I have been working on one, and I'm afraid that I may be dead right. Exxon might not like it.
Isn't that too bad?
Yes, but how do your gentlemen consultants deal with the possibility that this is not going to be popular with the economic powers that be?
The other word on that is, isn't that too bad? Here's the most important group of people in the world, and the most powerful group of people in the world is not Exxon and the rest of it. It is the American public.
I totally agree, sir.
The aroused American public. Now, when the American public begins to understand that free energy is here, no longer are we going to see the days of J.P. Morgan and the rest of them, where the large corporations and the bankers and the rest of them can sweep it under the carpet. It just will not be allowed to happen. Nobody cares. And we don't care about Exxon or the rest of them if they're going to try to deny you and me and the American people their right to have free energy. Now, media will certainly get into the fray. And as we said at town hall the other night, if any politician, if any bureaucrat, if any large corporation tries in any way to thwart the development and the distribution of free energy to the people of the United States, their name, rank, serial number, photograph, telephone number, and address will become a household word in every home in America. And what are you going to do about them, America? And I'll tell you what you're going to do, what they will do about them real fast. Well, I don't need to. I think you can see it.
I appreciate your strong comeback. Will we have their fingerprints also?
Well, we'll take those if it's necessary, but they will not be able to stop it.
Because I have been holding back, perhaps in a paranoiac imagination, of being one person that comes up with something and Texaco is out of business, except for petrochemical.
Well, you're not going to put the oil companies out of business. There are a great many uses for petroleum products other than to burn them and ruin the ecology of our planet. We're at a critical point on that. But by the proper use of petroleum products, we can make millions of acres of arid land fertile again. We can provide homes, clothing, shelter, food, medical needs. There's a myriad of uses for petroleum products other than ruining our environment.
I totally agree, sir. A few technical questions for your gentleman.
Mm-hmm.
Are we talking about manipulating current mechanical devices, or are we talking about tapping into essentially etheric energy?
Well, the word etheric energy, if you'll substitute for that scalar electromagnetics, it's exactly the same thing. It's actually the ether, but it's a little bit different ether than they used to have in the old ether theory. By the way, ether is now an accepted concept again. It is now used in physics again. It's used in the sense that Einstein proposed it. It's used as applying to the vacuum, which is considered to be a flux of virtual particles. It's a funny little gas, in other words,
right,
that instead of being material, the little particles appear and disappear very rapidly, so rapidly that each one can't be detected. But between them all, they have a high pressure. So the vacuum has become a new kind of ether. The difference is it's not filled with particles like a normal gas that stay around all the time. The little particles are appearing and disappearing all the time.
Is the flux measurable?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm on the right track. I'm working in totally different lines than you folks.
Oh, that's great, Richard, because there are a lot of lines to work on, and the more people that work on them, the more people that bring it out into the open, the greater it is.
Could I ask a question, Steve, real quickly?
Sure.
When it comes time to get off the drawing board and onto the breadboard, and I admire you folks that have, where do I go to find the man that can put the mechanics behind the idea?
Well, you're talking to one.
Well, you go to any machine shop where it has machines, and what's good about it, you don't have to use no exotic metals. All the metals we use is brass, steel, and aluminum.
There's one more. I'm working with Monell.
Yeah.
But no problem?
No problem there. But you definitely have to use brass or aluminum. It will not work.
I'd like to know why, if you have a moment.
Well, it affects a magnetic field, and the magnetic field works entirely different than the magnetic field we're normally to understand. And that brass bar has a lot to do with any current, if I am mistaken, on the magnetic field when the bars have a dead short.
Uh-huh.
And the trick is you have to know somebody who knows how to wind them coils for you on the bars. And it's really, you can do them by hand. That's the way we first made them.
I'm not going to wind, sir.
You're not going to wind?
No, sir.
You ought to see some of the winding these guys do.
I've been listening for an hour and a half, and I can imagine going 32 wire times whatever it takes for a coil. But this is direct.
With a 5 miles of wire in one of those coils?
No.
That's very interesting.
I have a very good idea. I know what he's going to do, but he's not going to use any coils.
Oh,
he's not going to. He's going to tap a completely different source, but done.
It's the same principle. Source.
Yeah, it's the same source.
Oh, right. You're going to do the same.
You're going to just utilize a different principle.
Yes, sir.
Okay, it's the same thing in the end.
Right.
And you will find the same breakdown problems as if you wound the coils.
Oh, really?
Yes. I already went that one.
You've already tried that. The coil down that trail.
Yeah,
that's a disaster I haven't encountered yet.
No, well, you know, anything that's on a anything that's theoretical off the computer or laid out on a piece of paper, you never know that if you put a piece of wax paper in between something, that some little spark's going to jump through and short out your condenser, right?
Right.
But the thing about this is that we found the most stable of the units was by winding the coils.
Mm-hmm.
Because, see, then we could control the wire size on the rotors. We did it very crudely. The wire that's on the rotors, by the way, is a number 18. Now, when Steve talks about brass, iron, and aluminum, these are all intricate machined parts. Like the rotors are iron, the center shaft is brass. It's a very important thing to remember that you don't want to disrupt this field when you make the two patterns.
I don't want to disrupt it. I want to manipulate it.
Okay, well, that's right. But you want to manipulate it into doing work for you. Okay?
Right.
You don't want to manipulate it into soaking up energy that you can't use. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Follow it.
But you're on the right track. That's the starting point right there, is with no coils and those three metals.
All right, Richard, does that help you?
One quick...
Make it real quick here.
Very quick. How to finance this. There is a public law that if you have a generator in your backyard, you can run it back through your utility lines, and the company has to pay you for it.
Yes, and the utility companies hate that because they may have a man working on the line out there, and you're running electricity back into it.
Can I say one thing, Bill?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I have a very good friend down the street from me who spent a lot of money on wind turbines, okay? Now, the nice thing about the Department of Water and Power is that they'll buy your electricity back, okay? But they're going to recharge you for that electricity at full cost. In other words, they're going to pay nothing for it. You're going to do the work. You're going to spend the $10 million or whatever it costs to put up your machine. You're never going to get paid back for it. You just cannot do it. You know, take wind generators as an example. Those people have never been paid off. They'll in 30 years, if they're lucky, they're going to break even. You see, they allow you to have all these things. The best thing you could do, sir, is to generate your own power and forget about selling it to them.
Also, what's interesting about this particular device we're talking about, the power it generates is the power you ask for, and it doesn't generate any extra. So if you're not going to be feeding the Department of Water and Power anyway.
the Department of Water and Power ask for all the power they can get. If you can shove it back through their lines, why won't they pay you?
Well, why shove it into them if you're going to have to pay for it back again?
full price.
You know, that doesn't make too much sense.
No, if I shove 10,000 kilowatts and use 1,000, I've got a 9,000 plus.
Well, if you want to try to feed them, but that isn't the idea of this. The idea is to make your home energy.
No, the idea of this is to pay for the research and development.
Well, here's the nice thing, Bill. There's one important thing that he hasn't discovered yet. You will not shove that energy which you are generating back into their lines because it's an absolute fight with that energy. In other words, their energy is not the same type as yours.
Right. I have to negate theirs to put mine in.
No.
No?
No, you're going to have to negate yours to put yours in there because yours is a different type of energy. It's not as simple as chopping off the peaks and then sending it back down the line, okay?
Okay.
I mean, so if you've got that concept in your mind, that's wrong right there.
Whoops.
Okay, and another thing, you're gonna severely heat their transformers.
Well, that's their problem.
Well, that's true.
That's right, but it's your problem in the end. And the taxpayers' problem when they got to replace that transformer on the pole.
There's another thing to bring in mind, that particular law that's on the books in the state of California was put on the books by a bunch of legislators that didn't understand physics, don't know anything about physics at all, and I can assure you that will be changed. They will be educated in Sacramento here in a very short period of time as to what is happening in the world of science and where politics and science don't often get along.
Oh, if any one of us could put 3 million kW into the line, it would be changed overnight.
Yeah, and there would be some transformers blown up along the way.
So that Bill, thank you very much.
All right, thank you, Richard.
I enjoyed the advice and your conversation.
All right, good to have you aboard, and get out there and keep going.
I'm
Bill Jenkins. It's Open Mind tonight. We're talking free energy, and there are a lot of things about it. Stay with. It's Free Bearden, John Bedini, Steve Wirth, Ike Mueller, Ramon Sanchez are all here. And within that, there are a lot of people who know a great deal about this thing called free energy. All the energy you can use that you'll ever need. And after you buy the device and then maintain it, it's not going to cost you anything. Now, I know it may sound technical to you from time to time, but I think it'll be well worth your time to stay with and find out more about this reality. It isn't a dream. It is here. It is now. And we have Faith on the line. Hello, Faith.
Hello, Bill. Mm-hmm. The two gentlemen before me come in with part of my questions that I wanted to ask them, and I feel proud to be able to even speak to gentlemen that are doing something for the world, as they are doing.
They certainly are, I think.
I wanted to know, like this gentleman said about the company buying it, what happened, they wouldn't let them have it. Back in 1927... they do like this now. In 1927, my brother was working in the Ford agency. They had a carburetor that was testing out for the Ford Motor Company.
Mm-hmm.
That carburetor, the car was on a new car. It was sold and wasn't, they didn't know anything about that carburetor on it, the fellow that sold it. The fellow drove that to San Diego, drove it around a week, drove back up here, and drove back down again, and he hadn't used a fourth of a tank of gas. That carburetor was taken. I had to give him $10,000 and give him a new car for that to get that carburetor back.
Well, that's true. Those things used to happen
in
the corporate system. The corporations would buy up technological advances, and particularly if it dealt with energy and dealt with the petroleum industry. But those days are gone. It will not happen again.
Pardon me.
Yeah, go ahead.
Will this, when they get it on the market, so we people like ourselves, I have a brother that lives up in the mountains,
mm-hmm.
and the electricity goes out on them part of the time there.
Mm-hmm.
Would one of these work in the mountains like that way?
It'll work anywhere.
It'll work anywhere.
Yes, it will.
Yes. Anyway. Well, thank you very much for letting me ask that.
Well,
interesting.
I really understand, a lot of people have the idea that the big companies won't let it happen, or the government or somebody, they won't let it happen. They are not going to be able to do that anymore, so don't worry about it.
I think that's marvelous.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much.
And we have Mark on the line. Hello, Mark.
How do you do?
All right.
Good. First question is, you were telling us at the beginning that different laws or the way we were taught earlier is wrong. I'd like to know what theories would still exist today or what theories still apply.
Oh, there are a bunch of them that apply, and I will let Tom get to that in just a second, but we want to take a break, Mark. Can you stay right there?
Okay, yes.
Okay, very good. Mark, now, sorry to break your chain of thought there, but let's get into it before we have to take a break, will you? Tom, do you want to answer that question?
Well, I want to have a cut at it. Let's say what a law of nature really is. Nature has no hard and fixed laws. What we do is we describe a general situation as general as we can, and we, so to speak, fix all the variables. And then as long as that thing stays linear and well-behaved and doesn't vary very much from what we're talking about, this particular law that we discover, which is usually written as a mathematical formula, it applies in that situation. Now, conservation of energy, for example, is such a law, and there are many others. Conservation of momentum, for example. Yet there are many cases where conservation of momentum does not apply. If you change the assumptions that are in that general situation that that law is written for, then you violate the law. In other words, the law doesn't apply. A new law or a variation of that law applies. What we're talking about here is we change the most basic thing that we know about, and that's space-time. Everything exists in that, the way we conceive it. So if we start being able to change pattern, form, shape, space-time itself at will, then literally you have the ability to change any law, and I mean that literally. We're seeing right now, and some things that we cannot talk about on the air, that that is a fact. It is not a conjecture. It is experimental fact. You can change some of the most revered laws of nature by simply changing the basic assumptions that they were written for. When you do that, you don't have to obey those kinds of things anymore.
Mark, does that help you out there? Hello? Well, I hope that answered the question there with Mark. Not all of the laws of physics are wrong, but what we want to do is throw out the ones that don't apply, keep the ones that do apply, add the new ones that really apply. And there's a mixture to be had there. We're talking about free energy tonight. It is real. It is with us. And we have another hour to discuss it with you, with some of the leading minds in the world on that particular subject. So stay with us.
Happy celebration 25.
Welcome into Hour 3 of Open Mind on a Saturday night on KABC. I'm Bill Jenkins, and this Saturday night we're talking about something that's very important to you and will hit close to home. Your ability to have free access to all of the electrical energy you need, and it isn't going to cost you anything. Sound interesting? Well, we've had an interesting 2 hours. Join us for the last one here. And to help us along our way in that conversation are some people who know probably more about that than anyone else in the world. We have Tom Bearden with us, John Bedini, who hasn't actually made the device, and it's there, Stephen Wirth, who puts all of these great ideas together. We have Ike Mueller and Ramon Sanchez, and you're certainly welcome to talk to any of these men about how you are going to get the energy that it's your right to have. There's no reason that you should be paying all this vast amount of money for it. And it's online and coming your way. And let's talk to Reza. Reza, hello. Hello. Have we got telephones in there? Okay, let me try to punch ahead. Reza, are you with us? Well, now, let me see. Are our telephone lines working? Hello there. I believe we are now.
Hello.
Yes.
Good evening, Bill.
Uh-huh.
Great show.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I guess I have a simple question. I don't understand some of the terminologies that has been used,
mm-hmm.
but I want to know how the system is hooked up together. And now let me tell you my understanding of how electrical energy is produced. What I know is you have an engine, internal combustion engine, like that turns a generator, and that generator produces energy. How does Bedini's machine compare to this, and where is that extra energy, or whatever you want to call it, produced?
Good question, and your understanding is pretty well correct for the way it was yesterday, but we're now talking about today and tomorrow. So put aside all of those ideas, and we'll let John talk to you. John?
Okay.
Now, let's go over this question a little bit. First of all, our generator doesn't use a gasoline-powered engine, okay?
Okay.
What you are referring to is a standard electrical generating system with potential drag, right?
Okay.
Am I correct? That's what you're referring to?
Yes.
Okay. All right. I can't go into all the details on how the generator's put together, but I can tell you of some experiments that were done that might help you. First of all, we have generators which run themselves with their own motor action, and then we have generators which use an electrical motor to drive the generator, and as we draw from the generator, the generator speeds up instead of slowing down. Okay, now conventional generation equipment is that you hook the light bulb to the generator, the gasoline engine slows down, and then you have to give the engine more gasoline to bring it back up so that you're back up to the right frequency again.
Okay.
In this generator, we run it approximately 59 cycles, almost 60 cycles, plus minus 10%, okay? And when we load down our generator, the motor speeds up. In other words, we reduce the power input. Now, knowing this, if we had it hooked to a gasoline generator, what we would be doing is throttling the gasoline generator down. We'd be burning less fuel for power output in kilowatts that the generator is going to put out. You understand what I'm saying?
It looks like in conventional, or as Bill says, yesterday systems, we have loss of energy in whatever terms, thermal or otherwise. And in this system, we have creation of energy along the line somewhere.
Right. The losses of energy in the conventional generator are that you're cutting those magnetic lines of force, so you're creating drag and heat. In other words, you're creating heat at one end to power the generator, and you're creating heat at the other end to get the electricity out of the generator. Okay?
Okay.
Those are very old laws, and they need to be revised. These are the laws that we're talking about that physics explains in their books that are rock solid. In other words, if you don't follow this law, you don't get any energy. Okay? Well, that's baloney. All right? That's just simple terms. If you violate the law and find a way to tap this field of energy, what you will get is acceleration and free energy by violating that law. Do you understand that?
I understand what you're saying. Now, one thing that I like to also know is, what is that space-time terminology that has been used during this show? How is it related to the system of generating electricity here?
I'm glad you asked that question, Risa, because it's a difficult one for us to comprehend, those of us that are not physicists. Whenever you are bending space-time, Tom uses that a lot, and he's explained it here before. Tom, you want to try it again?
It's really a fairly simple term. If you look at vacuum, which is space-time, as an ether of the new type that we talked about a while ago, if you will consider a rough analogy that the vacuum already has a pressure of this virtual gas that it is, that pressure would be the potential. The swirl in that would be, for example, the magnetostatic potential. But if you make waves in this potential, one wave that will go up in a peak, and that is more density of this virtual gas. Now, I'm using an analogy here. In the trough of the wave, it's less density or less intensity of the flux, less intensity in the virtual pressure. So if you look at it as a sort of a crazy pressure wave, what you have is the pressure, so to speak, in this crazy vacuum going up and going down, pulsating. Now, that's a scalar wave. That's the kind of thing we're talking about. But what we've done is pointed out that electromagnetics itself, the present one taught in the books, has some severe shortcomings that were just misses or best guesses 100 years ago or so when they put that stuff together. And nobody's ever gone back and dug those out and corrected them for what we know today. We've learned a lot about physics since then. And if you do, you get a much more extended electromagnetics, which I've been calling scalar electromagnetics. That's where the terminology is coming from. So what we've been doing is building a bridge, just like you went from Newtonian physics to relativistic physics when Einstein came along. You got a little bit of an extension to it. The electromagnetics has the same kind of an extension that can be done, and that's what John's working in. He's working in the extended electromagnetics, which includes what you got in the book and a lot more.
Does that help you now, Reason?
Yes, it does.
I think, you know, one of the things I think we need to remember is that we talk about, and the scientists quite often talk about, are from the great citadels of learning. You'll hear, these are the laws of physics, as if the laws were handed down by the lawmaker, the creator of the universe. Well, he didn't give us those laws. There's no stone tablets that came off the mountain that are in the laws of physics. And quite often they just are inappropriate now, and it's time to change them all. And it's one thing to talk about it, but it's another thing to see a device and to see it work that is in violation of the laws of physics, which shows that they really aren't laws at all. They're just somebody's idea that no longer applies. You're on Open Mind tonight. I'm Bill Jenkins. We're talking about free energy. It may be a little bit technical for you from time to time, but I think it's well that you stay with us if you can, because it's going to directly change your life. Not just that. Hello, Craig. Hello there. Do I need to punch it again? Hello.
Can you hear me, Arthur?
There we go.
Hi, Bill. Nice to have you back.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
We were a little worried about you last week. I was telling my wife, I thought, well, I wasn't sure what might have happened. Maybe you finally got out of body and couldn't come back.
It was about as bad, but I did make it back, and everything is under control, right?
Okay, I've got some questions, yeah. First, before my questions, just one small comment on the notion of violating the law of conservation of energy. I think, actually, we just have to redefine the parameters of that.
Well, that's one way to put it, a nice way to put it, yes.
Oh, would you agree? I'm specifically talking to Tom Bearden right now.
Yes, if you include energy
in the virtual state.
In the virtual state, that's true. You don't violate the overall conservation of energy of the universe. You violate it locally.
Yeah, I think it would go. That concept would go down a lot better with physicists than other people.
Well, it goes a little further than that. You see, number one, we're not too interested in how well we go down. We gave that up a long time ago. I don't mean to be flippant with that at all. And I certainly have great respect for the hard work that the physicists are doing and have done. I'm just saying that we must not ever become dogmatic in physics, and we must never say, this cannot be done. Usually when that statement is made, it's usually done very shortly thereafter. Otherwise, we get like some of the people were at the beginning of the atomic bomb. We say, you know, the thing will never work. Well, it did work. The business of energy itself is presently a concept which is misused in physics. It's used in two fashions that are diametrically opposed to each other, and the difference between the two has not been recognized. Now, there is a technical difference between those ways it's used. It should be used rigorously only when you ultimately refer to a single force vector moving against a resisting mass. It has been used, for example, with a potential where you have many vectors essentially summing to vector zero. It does not rigorously apply to that case. A potential has no energy. It has energy which has turned into a different form, just like mass is energy in a different form. And that should be clearly differentiated in physics, and it is not. So for that reason, the word conservation of energy, as a matter of fact, we've written a new conservation law. We've created a term for the multi-vector system, the zero-vector system that consists of a whole bunch of vectors. We call that an energy to make it technically correct. And energy. Not energy, but you can get energy from it. And we've written a law directly with that, which the present conservation of energy is a special case, just exactly like you do when you go from Newtonian physics to relativistic physics. It has to fade back into the old physics in the limit. And that's the way this thing works. But you can get around the present conservation of energy law when you look at what you've got available from the potentials, that is, from the vacuum.
Concept.
Yeah, we're not intending to imply that you get something which appears out of nowhere and never was existing anywhere else. So the universe is literally filled with enormous amounts of energy and this new form of it, if you will permit that expression, in even the smallest part, even in 1 cubic centimeter. There's just enormous amounts in there if we can transform it into usable energy that we can use. And, of course, that's been in physics a long time.
How does this work into the concept of the Big Bang? Has anybody done work on it?
The Big Bang?
Yeah.
I've not done any work at all on that.
I mean, you know, the theoretical physicists go through all the calculations of what happened in the first microsecond and, you know, where the energy came from and all that. But if we're going to include the concept of the scalar wave energy, doesn't it have to be revised?
Well, Professor Ramon Sanchez is here, and his eyes lit up at that question, Craig, so let's let him go on.
Well, non-physical forces, of course, are behind all the physical forces that we have in the universe. Fields, of course, affect matter. You have a magnet that has a field that you cannot see, you cannot taste. But in an interaction between two fields, you have a force, which is a vector force. Now, before the Big Bang, there was a non-physical energy, call it scalar or whatever. Now, that created a phase 90 degrees to that energy and created an explosion, if you believe the Big Bang. I think that the expansion was detected as a glow. And this glow is prevalent around the Earth's atmosphere. And part of that makes up what we call now the Van Allen radiation belt. You see, besides radioactivity, the high levels of background radiation, you have scalar waves, and they originate from the point of the explosion that are still traveling and still expanding. Now, they still have to phase couple to create energy, so you have suns forming and things like that. You have the sun emitting regular electromagnetic energy, and you have scalar radiation from the sun. To prove that point, if you have a space probe just above the Earth's atmosphere, you will detect 10 milliwatts per square centimeter. But on the surface of the Earth, it's 14 milliwatts per square centimeter. So there's an increase. That increase is due to scalar in, going into a coupling effect.
On this figure, are you talking across all bandwidths?
Yes, the scalar bandwidth has its own spectrum. I did experiments showing that scalar radiation can be reflected. And if you take a prism, the rays will reflect in the material. Let's say you have a piece of glass. That in physics is called refraction. Now that bending changes with the bandwidth. Now the lower bandwidth will bend the least and have less energy. The higher the bandwidth will bend the most, having more energy. That separates the bands, and you have a scalar spectrum. So it includes all bands, yes.
Hmm. Okay, what about specifically reworking the calculations for the Big Bang Theory? Has anybody worked on it?
Well, they're constantly debating and going at each other's throats. To this day, the controversy hasn't ceased. And even in philosophy, you have the Indian philosophy, you probably know the yoga, and you have the creationalists. Now, the yoga says that the Earth is a creation of a Big Bang explosion, creating the whole universe that ends. In other words, there's an ending. And the creationalists, which means the people that study the Bible, the Judeo-Christian tradition believes that the universe will never end and will continue to expand, creating more and more. Now, there's two camps of scientists. Some believe that the universe will stop, and of course, the proton, as we know it, will decay. There's some evidence to that effect, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's not recreated. I believe that in scalar fields, and there's been some evidence that light has formed into matter at extreme distances from the Earth, next to the edge of the known universe. So that would good evidence for scalar interference, even creating matter. And if light actually light is the process where matter is created. Now,
The answer to your question is that there's two camps of scientists. One believes that the end of the universe is at hand, and the other believes that the universe will slow down and stop altogether because it's closed. And the other believes that energy is constantly being created. Now, Albert Einstein was in, he thought that the universe would continuously expand, and that there was only a change of energy, only in form. And he developed the wormhole theory, which is now the black hole theory, where you have black holes and white holes, where it enters into another dimension or hyperspace and into a other universe. Or a white hole is becoming in our universe energy. Now, that's general relativity. Now, we can do this on a laboratory bench and change that. I have done experiments where I can essentially produce a black hole or a white hole, creating a hot spot or a cold spot where energy sinks back into the surrounding universe. Now, any scientist that does not believe that is because of relativity on Earth, because, first of all, it takes enormous amounts of energy, and second of all, if you did create a black hole, you'd suck in all the planets in your neighborhood. You know what I mean, right? And that's not the case, because, you see, the hole rotates, and, of course, the singularity doesn't occur, so you won't have to worry about that. See, there's a lot of things that they haven't charted. Now, one of the things that makes it possible control this is maybe intergalactic travel. Warp travel is now around the corner. Teleportation is feasible, and many other interesting things.
Let me get back to some question I had for Tom. Last time we talked, I brought up the possibility that scalar waves could couple with atomic nuclei. You hadn't mentioned it. It just seemed plausible, and now you brought it up again tonight. You said that scalar waves are generated in atomic nuclei, and that, in fact, all atomic nuclei in the universe are in scalar wave communication with each other, which leads me to a question of what is the speed of propagation of the scalar waves?
It can vary from below the speed of light to far above the speed of light. It depends. The reason I say that, it depends on several factors. And we only have indications of this so far, but it's well known, for example, at least in the Russian work, that the speed of light in a hard vacuum on the surface of the Earth is already faster at the fourth decimal than the speed of light in a hard vacuum away from large planetary masses and the sun, in deep space, in other words. That's been in the literature and been known, rather, for 80 years and been just ignored in the West. If you make forms of the scalar by multiple frequencies which act as a Fourier expansion, so they make a geometrical form, say like a ball, for example, a simple one, that ball can travel far, far slower than the speed of light, or it can travel faster. It works like a soliton. The more energy you got in it, the faster the thing can go. In other words, the more you warp space-time, is what we're saying, the more the speed to the external observer can be higher, or appear to be higher, and it's really higher. So you can get any kind of velocity out of the thing you want, including a standing scalar wave, which is what a mass is.
Right. This seems to lead up to the concept of tachyons, which most physicists, of course, regard as imaginary particles. Could you go into that?
Well, the best comment I can make on a tachyon is I consider the tachyon to be nothing but a virtual particle. At least one of the leading Soviet physicists agrees with that in his book, Paradoxes in Relativity. He points out that every virtual particle has to be going faster than the speed of light, or it couldn't stay virtual.
Which physicist was that?
Just a moment. His name temporarily eludes me, but someplace around here in my briefcase,
okay.
I've got his name.
How do you remember a Russian name? You know,
I have difficulty pronouncing it.
All right, Greg, does that help you?
How are you looking for that? Let me just ask you one last question then. Since you've confirmed the fact that scalar waves do have the ability to couple with the strong nuclear force, does this mean that we have the possibility in the future of, number one, disarming nuclear weapons, and number two, a means for nuclear waste disposal?
You got it.
You're right on target.
Is this being worked on, or can you talk about it?
We would be extremely happy to work on either one of those once we're funded.
Once everything is done, that'll be one of the things that's done. Let's put it that way.
Anybody doing theoretical work on this?
Correct.
Yes, I will tell you this, and I dare not mention his name. A personal friend of mine is far deeper into that field and far further along than you would dare dream, or even I dared dream until recently. Mm. And beyond that, I really wouldn't dare say anything about it.
Well, I'd sure love to have some more on that.
Well, just stay tuned, folks. All right, Craig?
Okay. Did you get that, David?
No, his briefcase is out in the car, so
we'll
get to that.
Listen, I thank you much.
All right, Craig. Thank you very much for your call. It's Open Mind. I'm Bill Jenkins. With me, a lot of minds, much greater than mine. Tom Bearden, Ike Mueller, John Bedini, Steve Wirth, and Ramon Sanchez. And we're talking about free energy and some rather exotic things which are going to make your tomorrow a much brighter day. Energy, it's here, it's online, and you have an opportunity to talk to some of the men that have made it possible, and Boris is here to talk about just that. Boris, welcome aboard.
Hello, Bill.
Yes.
I saw your demonstration. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, can you speak up just a little? I'd appreciate it.
All right. Is that better?
That's better.
All right. I saw the demonstration Tuesday down there at the Biltmore.
Yes.
And I'll get right to the point. On the basis of what was shown to me, I don't think you have a free energy device, and I'll explain why.
Well, that'd be very interesting. I'd love to hear it.
I was looking at those bulbs, and there were about six of them, and I would estimate from the demonstration that I saw that each of those 100-watt bulbs had approximately 25 watts in it when he had that thing running, which would come to a total of about 150 watts. And meanwhile, there was a 30-horsepower motor operating, which is rated output in energy of 250. Now, if you're getting 150 watts from a 250-watt source, then your efficiency comes out to not 180%, but about 60%.
Did you count the heater that was also running down between the bulbs there, which is a 600-watt heater?
No, I don't know about, but that could have certainly improved the rating.
That's right.
But
it certainly did.
The question that I'm raising is, do we have a free energy device, or do we have a bunch of professors who are so high up in the air on theory that they've forgotten their elementary measurements? Could you convince me that you're really getting anything more than 100%? Let me tell you what you would have to do to convince me.
All right, let's see what
you'd put a light meter up next to those bulbs, take a reading, and then substitute some regular power in there, known and easy to measure, and get the same reading, and let's see just how much watts you've got in that thing.
Fair question. And we have some fair answers here for you. John, Ike, which one of you want to handle that one?
There? I'll do that.
Okay.
Okay, first of all, before I screwed in the bulbs and before I started the demonstration, I explained exactly what I was going for. I had to load that 600-watt quartz heater. Did you see how bright the 600-watt quartz heater was?
Well, I don't know much about the quartz heater.
Well, that was all running down the center.
Those were 100-watt bulbs.
No, no, no.
Those are at full brightness. You can't look at them.
No, no, no. You're missing the whole point of that demonstration. You see, you are looking at things conventionally. And looking at that conventionally, you are absolutely right. However, when I unscrewed all the light bulbs from that setup, the quartz heater was well over what it was supposed to be, and the motor was under acceleration. Okay? Now, the motor draws 5.5 amps from the wall. That's 1/3 horsepower at the efficiency of 80% on the electric motor.
Okay.
Is that agreeable with you?
Yes.
Okay. Then if I was not putting out 600 watts, that motor would be under drag, wouldn't it? The motor stopped when I disconnected the load, right?
Are you there, Boris?
Yeah.
Did the motor stop?
I saw that part. I didn't see the motor stop.
Did the motor stop? No, no, no. If you saw the lights, you saw the motor stop. Okay? I very conveniently pulled off the wires and the motor stopped dead because the 1/3 horsepower motor could not drive that load. Now, that was, everybody applauded when those wires were pulled off. Okay? So right then and there, you see, this efficiency factor that you got is all blown apart. Okay?
No.
Yes, it is, because if the 1/3 horsepower motor can't turn the generator, then there's no point in even taking this discussion any further, because the 600-watt load, there were people who saw it run, was very brilliant. In fact, it was on the verge of melting the glass on a number 32 wire.
Well, that 32 wire would carry the load that I saw in there of 150 watts.
You're forgetting the 600-watt heater in
That's
there
right.
that ran down the middle.
That's right. The 600-watt heater is what you saw glow until I screwed in the light bulbs. Now, what I was trying to accomplish there was to make a heater load of 2,000 watts, which glows. You follow me?
All right.
Okay. So that means now that I have to disperse my power through that number 32 wire, okay? And I want a orange glow. And yes, you are correct. By taking a photon meter, whatever you want to do to measure that light, that would be the actual way to convert that energy into usable wattage, or the best measurement technique, since you can't insert the meter in the line. Also, at the same time, when the 600-watt load was being brilliantly lit, and I mean the tape is available for anybody that wants to see John disconnect the wires, okay? Also, that 600-watt load was so intensely hot that me and Steve dare not run that thing for more than 10 minutes, okay? There's no point in exploding quartz glass all over the audience, but the point is...
Well, I felt those bulbs, and they were cool.
Well, you were standing behind me, and I know exactly what it was, and the point is that there was a guy on the program earlier who measured the batteries. You have to take into account you got mechanical energy for free and acceleration. You got the batteries recharged that were driving the field. And you also got the 600-watt quartz load driving at full brilliancy. And the only time that you saw that dim down is when I screwed in all the light bulbs. And then how do you account for the 2,000 watts left over in the generator?
I don't think that counts for anything. You could have a locked rotor condition in there that would stop that engine.
Well, now, wait a minute. Now, I didn't build a magnetic brake here, okay? I mean, look, the point is, at any point in time, this is on tape. You may call me up, and I'll send you the tape, and you can watch yourself all over again.
Well, right. I've made my point.
You've made your point, but your analyzing factors are off, okay?
Morris, do you agree, as you were watching that, if John didn't have any load on there at all, and that happened, he did it 3 or 4 times, that little third horsepower motor would not turn the generator. It would sit there and burn out the motor.
Well, that doesn't prove a thing.
Well, the next step is, once you started putting load on it, the little third horsepower motor would finally start turning that generator. And the more load you put on it, the faster it would turn. And if you take the load off of it...
You're breaking up the resonance that he's got from those coils and the capacitors in there. Well, I don't want to argue anymore. let me just drop it right here, okay?
All right, Morris.
One more point. It was very interesting that lady called on that carburetor. I've got a paper on that carburetor, and if you want, I'll write in and give you some information.
Oh, I'd love to have it.
Okay.
Yeah, there are a lot of those horror stories that the corporations have pulled off, and it's good to kind of load the arsenal with all of that, because we're going to have to face that down the line.
Okay, I appreciate very much the chance to draw away with you, and carry on, and I hope you do make the thing work.
Okay, it is working, but thank you, Boris.
All right.
Well, it's open mind. And it's good to have the skeptical minds. And they came down and looked, and maybe he's got a little more convincing to do. But that's all right. He could have spent more time with it. I think he might have seen. But he'll get a chance to see again. We'll be back in just a moment. And we just talked to Boris, and now we're talking to Jerry. Jerry, did you hear what Boris said?
Yes, I did. Can you hear me?
Yeah, did he give you any doubts about what we're talking about?
No, not at all. I've read the papers published by Tesla, and I've read all the articles and Let's Talk and so on.
Mm-hmm.
question, original question has been answered, so I would like to turn practical here for a minute. We've been technical for quite a while. This is to the fellows there in the studio. What are you now doing, and what should we as potential end users be doing now to ensure that this is mass-produced as quickly as possible and at the lowest possible cost?
Okay, I'm going to maybe break a little bit of silence here and say that we have been for some time engaged in very serious negotiations for commercial funding of this under the necessity for guarantee that it be brought to market, it not be suppressed, and it be brought to market at a fair market price to benefit the people. Obviously, if you do something like that, you'll make money, but the intent is not to rip everybody off, but to get the thing on the market, get it built, developed as fast as possible, and get it on the market. The reason for coming on the radio and for going forth with the papers and with the concepts is the reason we haven't had one of these before has been the person kept everything to himself, trying to get that patent and trying to get down the road with an invention that he could bring to market.
I see.
And it turns out that that alone won't let you get there. There's been at least 40 or 50 free energy devices built in this country alone and almost ruthlessly suppressed. Now, John made a break with that tradition and actually released information. We don't know everything yet about scalar electromagnetics. We're still finding out. We don't know everything yet about detectors. We're still finding out. And we don't know everything yet about all the phenomenology. We're still finding out. But if we can bring this one product onto the market line and prove conclusively what we're talking about, then we'll have every university in the country diving into and delving in this kind of electromagnetics and new things. And we'll have all of the, we in fact already have many, many independent inventors and tinkerers and scientists and engineers out there that are, in fact, building and tinkering down in their workshop. I guess the biggest thing to say is we want to give everybody hope. Everything is not cut and dried, and not everything's been found out yet. And there's still room for the guy who works with his hands and is willing to take a chance that maybe he can tinker something in to work that isn't written up in the textbook. And I'll tell you this. I don't think anybody in the United States or the world understands all there is to know about electromagnetics. Does that help you, Jerry?
Yes, it does. I admire John very much for his efforts in trying to get this out to as many people as possible and not being greedy about the thing. I also, let me ask this one last question. How far do you think we are from being able to order one of these things from Sears and bring it home and hooking it up?
Somewhere between 12 and 18 months.
And there's a lot of work involved in getting that done, not only the technology, but some politicians and bureaucrats are going to have to be hit on the head and a lot of things like that. But the work is underway. There are a lot of people behind this that want you to have free energy at the lowest possible price. And that's the way it's going to be. Does that help? Did my earphones go out? Okay. All right. Thank you very much. We'll get back to as many of the callers as we can in just a moment. One or two, maybe, because we're about to run out of time. Mark, put your question to us real fast here, would you? Because we're just about out. But go ahead.
Good evening. Really enjoy the show.
Thank you.
Okay, the question I had, a couple of questions follow along with what Jerry had to say. First of all, how much power does your actual working model that you have put out compared to the amount of power required to run the average home?
Okay. Actual working power is limited by the rotors and limited by the magnetic field which we're setting up, okay? The mechanical energy that's being delivered into the load plus the radiation from the quartz heater. The quartz heater is a 600-watt quartz heater that is found in any standard Xerox machine. It's that white light that goes across the paper, okay?
Uh-huh.
That requires 600 watts for full brilliancy. We were over that amount on the demonstration. It was measured by the use of a photoelectric meter, okay? plugged into the wall with number 12 wire. We've got a reading of 10 on the meter, and hooked up to the machine with number 32 wire, we've got a reading of 14. Okay, now does that tell you anything about how much more the machine is putting out?
Well, what I'm trying to get is the unit that you have now, how far away is the actual unit that's going to be required for to power an average home?
It's not far away at all. There are some alterations to be made in the rotor poles so that you may drive regular induction motors, okay? You must remember, as I explained before, that if you had a two-pole induction motor, that generator will drive it. You cannot put a regular induction motor on that right now because it only has two poles.
Okay.
What we're dealing with here is a simple laboratory breadboard model that proves a theory.
And
the theory has been proven and proven and proven again. And it's just a matter of a little engineering to take the theory now and put it into the little thing a little bit bigger than a bread box that will power all of the energy that you will need in your home. And that's just around the corner. It's not that far away.
Okay, one more quick comment. The thing that's really been bugging me about this, and you've, I know you've had this topic on several times.
Yes.
As Bill, you mentioned, and I also believe that the public's knowledge of this technology would be a real powerful force in the actual coming forth of this device.
It is absolutely vital.
What can we do? Why can't we get this in the mainstream news? It seems like the media would really want to jump on this. Let's get him on Michael Jackson's show.
Our time is running short, but let me put it to you this way, Mark, because I reach it all the time, that when an editor gets a hold of a story about a free energy device, he becomes an instant physicist if he's at a television station and he says, that's snake oil, he'd rather get a picture of a wreck, you know, down on the road. So it's a matter of educating the media, too, and we hope we can. And I appreciate your concern and your question. And our time is gone. We'll see you next week. I'm Bill Jenkins. And thank all you guys for being here.